So we have our tobacco thrips. We get those every year. And so kind of the issue is more of the wheat that we grow down here is really for sandblasting. So we're going to put it in a Gandy box. When we pull the beds, we're going to put it in the middles, and it kind of provides us a little break there from the sandblast issues because of the high winds we typically have. So with that, we naturally have a higher thrips population.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Mark Licht, Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist at Iowa State University. Please subscribe to our channel to receive notifications of new episodes. Today, we have Chase Floyd on the show. He is an assistant professor in extension, state extension crop protection specialist from University of Missouri at the Fisher Delta Research Extension Education Center. Today, we're going to be talking about pest management in cotton and rice. Chase, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here. It's we've gotten a lot of snow, which I'm not really used to. So glad that I could be able to make it and the roads were clear. So
And the best part is you got all that snow, and up here in Iowa, we got none of it. So
you can gladly have it back.
So. Okay. I'll tell my farmers that. So let's start the conversation today, by telling the audience and talking about what's your kind of your educational path and what really brought you to University of Missouri.
Okay, yeah, that's easy. So I'm from Southwest Tennessee. So I'm from right on the Shelby County, which is Memphis and Fayette County line. Not a lot of row crops, more hay and livestock. And when I went to college, I went to Mississippi State University. And my dad always jokes about this, but back in the day, he always said, when they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. So I go down there and I'm broadcast meteorology, looking for my break on TV. And after about a semester, I was like, yeah, don't really, this isn't for me. I loved ag, had a couple mentors growing up that really got me into row crop ag. And so I swapped over to integrated pest management. Finished there in 2016, wasn't ready to leave quite yet. And I'd just been working on a farm, on the research farm out there as an hourly, you know, my entire undergrad. And, you know, my advisor said, hey, or what do you plan on doing? I said, I don't really know. I guess I'll go into sales somewhere. And he's like, well, why don't you just stay here? I'll pay you to do it. And I said, I get to stay and get paid? Nice. So I went and did that and worked for him for another 2.5 years and kind of knew I wanted to be a bug man after that. I just love crop consultants, love visiting with them, and they're so knowledgeable. And I just loved, I typically say this a lot, when it came to IPM, you had to take X amount of disease, X amount or pathology, X amount of into, X amount of weed science. And I said, well, if I want to kill something, I want it to be able to run away from me. So that's always been my little joke. So wanted to be a bug man, decided to go to the University of Arkansas. I knew nothing about rice, and they said, we've got a rice project for you, and you're going to learn. So went over there and did that, and it kind of opened the door here at Mizzou in Southeast Missouri, because my dissertation, the insect I was working on, has been quite a problem here. And so I feel like the rice growers were like, hey, we've got this problem we need solved. This would be kind of the perfect cap for it. So ended up here and, you know, not too far from home, about 90 minutes. So it's a win for me and my wife and my kid. And so, yeah, I've been here since 2023.
Oh, that's exciting. You know, you said that you started out, you know, thinking about Saturday Night Live and in broadcast meteorology, and it did make me chuckle a little bit, I have to admit. But hey, this isn't your first podcast that you've been on. So you're not maybe straying from some of that too far. You're still tipping your toes into it, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
So you said that you worked on entomology in your dissertation work, your PhD work. What insect did you work on?
So it's the rice billbug. And so it's been around. It's not like a new invasive pest that we hear a lot about this year. There's been quite a few, but basically they've started to change the system. Not from, you know, when you think rice, you just think of it. I call it water wheat. So it's just like flooded wheat, treat it like that. But they're getting away from with water mitigation and things like that, especially fields that require a lot to zero grade. They're planting it on rows, and so they're rotating it with beans. It's a good, you know, beans and rice are a really good rotation. So they're taking the beds from the previous bean year, coming back in and planting rice into it, and so it's still on a grade. So typically, you'll put a levee on the bottom, flood it back up. Well, now that it's not completely underwater, this bug that's been, I should say insect, I know better than that, but this insect that's been pretty restricted to the levee for decades now has an opportunity to get in these higher ends of the field where it's dry and feed. And so we're looking in the Mid-South about, on average, 30% of the total rice acreage is in this new system. And so we were just trying to make sure that we had this pest under control and how much yield loss we were actually seeing from it. And so what we looked at was chemical efficacy, you know, what could we do to the field to back up more water? Because we knew the water restricted them, but we didn't know how much water we needed. So we looked at all things like that, trying to get the pest under control.
Oh, very good. And then obviously that work all landed you at the Fisher Delta Center. So I'm familiar with the University of Missouri system and a little bit about agriculture in Missouri. It's a neighboring state, right? So I get that connection. How is kind of this Fisher Delta Center, you know, what is its primary focus and how does that differ from some of the other research centers around the state?
Yeah, so the Fisher Delta Center is really unique, right? Because if you think about it, Mizzou in Columbia is the Midwest down here. And I mean, we're probably 25 miles from the Arkansas line. We're in the Mid-South. So it's Mizzou's way to make sure that all their stakeholders are represented. So, you know, I'm at a Mid-Southern research station at a Midwestern college. So they have to bring personnel in from the South that have a little bit more understanding of the cropping systems down here. We have peanuts, cotton, rice, you know, beans, corn, wheat. We grow everything. A lot of melon production down here as well. And then some pockets with peaches and things like that too. So it's really unique in that way because you're 45 minutes from essentially the Midwest and you're in the Mid-South right on the Mississippi River. So, you know, the farming practices are different. And in terms of entomology, the more southern you are, the heavier the insect pressure is, right? We get a lot of pests out of South America most years, and in those warmer states, they're able to overwinter. So I always kind of say we're kind of like the Hoover Dam of the Midwest. Like where I am is like, you go much higher than me, the insect pressure drops off, but I'm still in the heat of a lot of heavy, heavy insect pressure. We spray a lot for bugs.
Yeah, Missouri is a really interesting state from that standpoint, right? You know, I think of, you know, the corn and soybean belts, you know, that definitely encompasses the northern part of Missouri for sure. But if you really look at even like soybean production, it really just follows down the Mississippi River. And so the Boot Hill and as you go further south, you get into a different environment, a different region still.
Oh, yeah. And it's such a good rotation for rice. And so it's a good rotation for rice. And typically on some of these heavier clays, it does, you know, a lot better than some of the other crops. So.
Sure, I can see that. And then, yeah, just because of how we, you know, traditionally think of Missouri being a Midwestern state, I imagine you rely a lot on those Mid-South, you know, experts, whether they're, you know, research only or whether they're research and extension.
Absolutely. We work really well with the University of Tennessee. The Jackson station's only 90 minutes from us. And then I have counterparts in Northeast Arkansas, which, you know, 35 minutes away. So we work really, really closely with them. And prior to us having a lot of staff here at the Delta Center, our growers relied a lot on the U of A as well as University of Tennessee for their, you know, questions and things like that, just because they are growing these crops as well. So it's been nice, and I think it's been really refreshing for our stakeholders here in Southeast Missouri to have a voice to go to, because most of them, if you ask them about the Fisher Delta Center, they either worked there when they were a kid or they spend a lot of time there. So we're doing a really good job of trying to pump some data out of here for our stakeholders and make sure that they feel represented by the University of Missouri.
Oh, that's great. That's really great. Okay, let's jump in and get a little bit more agronomic or more technical here. So what are the main pest threats that you focus on and that have been a primary issue, you know, for the growers there in the Boot Heel?
Yeah, so I'll start with cotton, just because that's where I spend a lot of my time. So we have our tobacco thrips. We get those every year. And so kind of the issue is more of the wheat that we grow down here is really for sandblasting. So we're going to put it in a Gandy box. When we pull the beds, we're going to put it in the middles, and it kind of provides us a little break there from the sandblast issues because of the high winds we typically have. So with that, we naturally have a higher thrips population. So especially if we're, you know, killing the wheat behind the planter, they're moving, you know, they don't really have a lot. And as soon as that cotton kicks out of the ground, they move right onto it. So early season, that's really what we're dealing with a lot. We do deal with spider mites quite a bit as well early. And that's typically if we're not as aggressive on a early post, like that first post application. If we're not aggressive on the pre and we start to try to kill, henbit is like a buffet for spider mites. And so if we don't get a hold of that henbit early and we try to kill it post, they'll walk right onto that cotton. Typically, we see it more later in the year when it's getting hot and dry, and it's very, very conducive for spider mites. Probably the biggest one we deal with, though, is the tarnished plant bug. We deal with that one. We spray for that one in cotton more than anything. We're looking at anywhere from 3 to 6 applications a year to control that pest. And it's all dependent on the corn. So they're a pollen feeder, right? So typically we can get our corn planted all in a really, really short window down here in the Boot Heel. So it all kind of all pollinates at the same time, kind of gets the dough around the same time and starts hardening up. Well, then they just move right in. About that time is when the cotton starts blooming. So they just kind of sink right into the cotton. So we deal with them pretty heavily. Like I said, 3 to 6 applications a year, depending on where you are, how close you are to corn has a lot to do with that as well. We don't really deal with the worms as much as they do down south, those Lepidopteran pests. Typically in really warm, dry, early fall, late summer is where we're going to really start catching flights if it's super hot and dry. But I would say thrips, plant bugs, and spider mites are going to be our three in cotton, which is where I spend most of my time. Rice, it's going to be the rice stink bug and the rice bill bug is really what we deal with the most. occasionally some army worms. If Texas will get a hurricane, they'll ride the hurricane and we'll catch a flight of army worms or something like that.
Wow. It's a challenge I can see to kind of keep on top of some of these insect pests that are jumping around. Sounds like a lot of pesticide applications because of it. I think of, a typical corn, soybean, management. We're looking at fungicides, almost every year for both corn and soybeans. Not always, but, the insecticide, some years yes and some years no. And that's just even a single application, right? And you're talking six applications, maybe in some of the cotton, management.
Yeah, cotton you have to be really aggressive with just because. So what we like to say in cotton is like it comes out of the ground and it wants to die. And then once it gets a couple leaves on it, then it won't die. It turns into the actual perennial that it is, and it gets real woody, and then it doesn't want to die. So you have to be really aggressive with cotton. I typically call it like my preteen daughter. She just doesn't want to do anything that I ask her to do. So like it's just gotta be a little more like firm. But with soybeans and stuff, two applications maybe at most, and that's if we're catching a late season Lepidoptera. Really what we're looking for is stink bug control.
It's a blessing to have winter. So with all these applications, of these insecticides, are you starting to see some resistance development and how is that being managed?
Yeah, so we do see resistance to some of our commonly used insecticides, especially like bean leaf beetles and things like that. Typically, we find a lot of those in the net. We are starting to see some pyrethroid resistance there, which I think is documented most places. With our thrips, our neonics are not working as well as they used to. So as a group, and I say as a group, the Mid-South Entomologist Working Group, we are always doing resistance screenings. It'll be one of us will text and say, hey, I need populations of thrips or I need populations of plant bugs. And then we'll start running bioassays and running resistance ratios and things like that. We try to rotate a little bit more, but options are limited, especially in the new agriculture system we're in, where we're trying not to use as much broad spectrum. I'm trying to be a little more site specific, but with those site specific insecticides, they tend to be a little more costly.
Oh, sure. Well, let's shift our focus just a little bit. You're new, you're young, you're energetic. That means you also have a new research program. What is your main focus at this point in time?
So really our main focus is I work a lot with insecticide efficacy just to have a more regional based data set for our growers to know what's the best product to spray when I have to. So my motto, and you, most of my stakeholders hear this on every time they hear me speak, is a day we don't spray is a good day. And my advisor always said that, and that really hit home with me. It's like, I don't want you to have to go out there and spend money if we don't have to. And so to do that, we've got to establish these insect pest thresholds. And so being able to do that is like, so you, the best way to explain it is you have two lines. So you have your economic injury level. So at this point, we're going to start losing money. I want to set a threshold slightly under that that buys you a little bit of time where you don't have to drop everything you're doing and call an airplane because you don't think you can get to the field. You can take a little bit more injury before you start seeing the losses. And we're trying to set these two lines because if you're above the economic injury level, it's more important to get it under control than what it costs. So like what I mean by that is like rescue option, right? So we need to spend some money to get this under control. Where if we're under the economic threshold line, we can be more mindful of our costs because we do have time and we're not at a point where we're losing money every day we don't do something. So we can be a little more strategic with our planning if we can keep it under that line.
Yeah, that's an ongoing process too, right? You have new products, you have resistance, and all that keeps changing really what those levels are.
Absolutely. And you have defoliators, which they have their own methods to be able to figure out what your defoliation level is versus one where you're looking at population density. Okay, I'm sampling X amount of bugs. That means I'm getting this much loss. Whereas, you know, with a defoliation, okay, I've hit a 35% defoliation point. Now I have to figure out what is doing it before I make that application. Because if I spray something that doesn't kill what's out there, then I'm just wasting my money. So it's all sorts of different ways you have to look at things, and you have to take everything into consideration. And is the pest more clumped? Are you going to see them heavier in one spot, or are they going to be uniform across the whole field? Can we make edge sprays? I mean, it's all things like that you have to consider. So it takes a lot of work and a lot of manpower to churn out that data.
Yeah, I would agree. It's really important work. It's just, it keeps coming back at us, right? You know, we talked a little bit on the pesticide efficacy, the injury levels. Let's switch over. Where are we at with the, so to speak, the pesticide applications themselves and some of the advancements that maybe are coming down the road with that?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think the biggest issue is we had a lot of products, and now those products are either one, phasing out, or two, it takes so much longer to get products labeled. So we have this gap where we now don't have as many tools in the toolbox anymore. And what we do have, it can be not as efficacious, so to speak, right? So looking at that, and that's kind of a lot of the work that I do, especially with the new insecticide draft strategy that came out last year. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and go through that whole thing, but basically, from a 10,000 foot view, is you have these certain areas called pulas. And so if you're within that pula, that means there may be an endangered species in that area. And so you require more mitigation points to justify that spray. So perfect example, there's a new insecticide that just came out. It requires two mitigation points, regardless if you're inside or outside. Now, once you get inside the pula, depending on what it is, you have to go on the website, figure out, okay, how many more mitigation points do I need to be able to justify this application? And so one of the biggest things that's kind of driven my program, because of course I walk in and here comes this new document that we're having to navigate and educate growers on, is what can I do to aid every grower? And so there's a list of mitigation points, right? But not every farm's the same. I mean, where you are, we were talking about this earlier, where you are, it's a lot larger scale operations. Whereas you get to West Tennessee or some of these areas in the Boot Heel, it may be a 10-acre block. So we want to make sure there's enough mitigation points to justify everybody and make sure everybody has enough that they need. And so I've been working with the National Cotton Council's been funding it, as well as Cotton Incorporated, but trying to provide data to the EPA for, okay, maybe if we don't have a bunch of new insecticides coming out of the pipeline, what if we adjusted how we made the application? Because the two biggest things with the insecticide draft strategy is runoff as well as off-target movement. So is there a way that we can adjust these applications to, reduce that? And so I started looking at the herbicide draft strategy, and I noticed that there was some applications for drop nozzles. I think the weed scientists don't love to call it this, but they still call it sloppy lay-by. And so they'll run a drop nozzle more concentrated down by those weeds, and they can do something that may be a little more harsh to the crop, but because it's not, you know, covering the crop, they're not seeing the injury and the plant's able to withstand it. So somebody had presented these drop nozzles. And so basically what it is, it's a puck and it's got two nozzles facing down right there at the base of the plants on each row. So my question was, well, what if I invert that puck? So my nozzles are pointed and they're spraying up. One, I'm not having to push through the canopy to try to get AI to the fruiting structures on this cotton. I'm able to blow it right onto the structures where the insects are. And secondly, if I've got my boom height 18 inches above the canopy, yeah, the wind can blow those droplets and yeah, we're going to have our off-target movement. But if I put it within the canopy, is that going to be able to have more surface area where those droplets can get stuck onto a plant and not be moving around so much? So that's been really, for the past 2 years, what I've been working on the most.
Really, the idea is rather simple, right? Get better on-target coverage and reduce the off-target.
And I will say this is, you know, I keep talking about products phasing out. A lot of these commonly used, and I call them middle tier, they're a little bit cheaper. Typically, we tank mix them with things because they're just not as efficacious anymore. But what we're able to do is we've been increasing control anywhere from 30 to 65% on some of these insecticides by just applying it where it needs to go.
Wow, that's a really good benefit, you know, that not only to your growers, but, you know, if we think about the endangered species, you know, right, you know, we're reducing that pesticide risk, we're reducing rates, but being more targeted with it.
Yes, absolutely. It's, you know, it's got its own implications, for sure. I mean, it's going to be costly on the equipment. I think to get it on, I know it won't go on a 120-foot boom setup. I know it will go on a 90, and that extra fold, it just doesn't set up right. But it, you know, it's a $15,000 investment, and you know, it's something too that I always try to point out that it's not something you're going to go corner to corner on your farm with, but it's going to be pesky areas where you have issues. You know, commonly every year, say, man, the guy next to me, he's going to grow corn. He's not a big rotator. He's always going to have corn right here. And I'll, you know, I tend to have cotton here most years. You know, that would be a good area for that, where you know you're naturally going to have a higher population.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, Chase, it's time for our final three questions. This has been a great conversation, but I'm going to keep us on target with the time slot anyhow. So let's start off with those three questions. And the first one is, what is your go-to agronomic resource?
So I would definitely say mine is probably, I stick to the Journal of Economic Entomology. So that's going to be your applied entomology. That's going to be looking at chemicals, seeing how they're profitable, seeing yield gain, you know, things like, or I don't want to say yield gain, yield retention. I'm in the retention game, not the yield game, game. So any of the ESA journals, Entomology Society of America. So that's going to be Journal of Economic, Journal of IPM, things like that.
Yeah, looking at those really applied journals. For me, it's the Crop Forage Turf Grass Management Journal. It's you know, very, very farmer focused, very, you know, crop consultant focused.
I love that journal. And the first time I ever published in there, I said I really, really like this because it is so farmer friendly. Pick up, can read it. It's in bushels. I really enjoy that one quite a bit.
Okay, question number two. What do you enjoy doing in your free time?
I am a gearhead to the core. I love working. I have a mini truck, one of those Japanese mini trucks, a Suzuki Carry. I work on it all the time. Last year for my birthday, my wife let me. I say she bought it. She says, I let you buy it. let me buy a 1987 Suzuki Samurai that I've been rebuilding. Still got the original engine in it, and I'd take it apart, put it back together, always try to soup it up. I always make my grad students learn how to drive stick before they leave, because it's always good to know how to drive manual. So I always have those, and, you know, my grad students all laugh because I'm always rolling up in some goofy little vehicle that I'm working on and stuff. And I'm also an avid turkey hunter. I'm addicted to turkeys. It is so much fun for me. So,
well, it sounds like you've got some things to relieve the stress of academic and research life, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. But then I decided to throw a 7-month-old into the mix in June. So, I haven't been as much of a gearhead this year, but I am enjoying fatherhood.
Good. And then our third question is, where can listeners go to learn more about your research and extension program?
Yes. So we, as the University of Missouri, we have really tried all of our extension personnel to try to put more information out there in an easier way to access. So our website is ipm.missouri.edu. Especially for our growers, we do moth catches. We have our moth catches across the state. We have all our worksheets. Like, we did a stink bug one in corn last year, things like that. So that we are really trying to amp up the output on that website. And so moving forward, please use that website as an option.
Yeah, I find that those land grant university web pages are fantastic. We have one at Iowa State, but I also follow all the surrounding states. And even as I go east into the Corn Belt more, you're right. Great resources there. Appreciate everyone's effort to put content on those. Well, that concludes another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Chase, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please like us and leave us comments. Your feedback is invaluable to us. Until next time, this is Mark Licht for the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.